Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. And this week, our special guest is Butch Smith, N4TK. And Butch is going to talk to us about VE testing, volunteer examiners, why you need to get involved. And he has some really, really good stories to tell about their experience here in the Nashville area with their volunteer examination team. So stay tuned. This is a good one. You're going to be glad you tuned in. This is also brought to you by Transworld Antennas, also PMC Science, Gigaparts, and Heil Sound. We'll be back with Butch Smith right after this. Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld Antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker and now the 4040. And, you know, we talk about it and we tell you, we say, if you want a stealth antenna that can hide in your backyard, if you want something portable that you can take with you, but you don't want to sacrifice performance with a portable antenna system, we tell you this is the antenna. But you know what? You probably don't believe me. So here's what I suggest you do. If you've been thinking about the 2010, if you have need of a portable antenna, especially during emergency operations, if you participate in emergencies and you need something you can set up quickly and reliably and get on the air, go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews. Or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. Don't even listen to what we're telling you. Don't pay any attention to what I say. Just go to EHAM and read the reviews. If you're thinking about a portable antenna, if you want something you can take with you on vacation, something that's attractive, that doesn't look like a bunch of poles sticking in 16 different directions, or a fishing pole hung over a tree limb or something, if you want something professional looking, something that's neat, easy, simple, but yet still performs, this is the antenna for you. Now, once again, don't take our word for it. Go to transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. Go to that site, read what's up there, and then check out the reviews, see what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. With us today is Truett Smith, N4TK, or do you prefer us to call you Butch?
I've been called Butch for 60-plus years and was called Butch when I came home from the hospital in 1948, so that's fine. Most people don't know me as Truett.
All right. Well, anyways, I don't want to go down the wrong road here. What is so fascinating about Butch is he has such a passion for the volunteer testing system. He and a group of fellows got together some years ago. And, you know, the procreation of ham radio is very, very important. It's important to me, and I think it's important to a lot of other people. And I hope when you listen to this and you hear Butch talk, that it's going to inspire you to do the same thing or duplicate what he is doing or get involved with a group that's doing this, because it is so cool. And I'll say this. I had come down with a flu. And I was supposed to go over and watch their testing session here not too long ago. And I was still sick. I still didn't feel very well. And so I got up and I was sitting here in the studios where I was sitting. And the phone rings. And it's Butch. And he says, you have a new general in the family. I said, what? What are you talking about? And my son David had got up and slipped out without letting anyone know, and went over to the testing center and tested and procured his general. He had a tech, and So, and that was was really amazing. Really surprised me, and I got a big bang out of it. And you'd have to be a father to understand that. But Butch called me and said, I got to tell you, you got a new general in the family. So, and he was.
I knew you had been really sick, because if you are going to come to take an exam, it's really easy to say, I'm sick, I can't come, I can't take the exam. But you weren't coming to take a test. You were coming to observe. So the fact that you didn't show up meant that you really were sick.
Yeah, I was just coming to observe because I was so fascinated by this. You know, tell us about how all of this got started. And why don't you first, though, tell us a little bit about how you got into ham radio?
Well, I had been interested in electrical things since, I guess, maybe I was 5 or 6 years old. My father and grandfather both worked for an electrical supply house, and electricity and wiring were just part of the family routine. And my father and grandfather would wire things and put in appliances in the house and rewire switches and lights and do all sorts of magic things with Christmas lights that it took somebody who understood electricity to do. And when I was 14, I started realizing that radio was very interesting. My grandfather had a shortwave radio set that I used to listen to, and it was an old tube type set. It quit working. I took it apart unbeknownst to my father or grandfather, and I saw that there was one tube that wasn't lit. And at 14, I had the resources to get another tube. I plugged it in there, and then all of a sudden it worked, and that hooked me. And in September of 1962, when I was 14, I passed and received my novice class license. My call was WN4JSX. And at that point, the license was good for a year, and then it expired. And before it expired, I managed to pass my technician class and became WA4JSX. And in another year, and this is kind of what has gotten me into the VE program, two of my friends who were hams in the Nashville community, and they are really the epitome of what an Elmer should be, Max Arnold, W4WHN, and Bill Bates, W4PRY, were holding classes on upgrading to general. And a lot of us who had tech licenses went to those classes once a week, and that prepared us for the code test and the written test that we took in September. And we did this all summer long, every week, all summer. And at that point, you had to take it in front of an FCC examiner. It was done in the post office. That was a federal building. There were marble floors, marble walls, columns, hard plaster. The acoustics were horrible. I was sitting probably 30 feet away from the tinny speaker where the guy was playing his tape for the code test. And somehow I passed 13 words a minute. But I had to send 13 words a minute, too, and I was very nervous sending. I had passed the receiving test, so he made me send, but I passed it, too. The FCC examiners didn't mean to come across as intimidating, but they were.
Oh, come on now.
Oh, this guy was probably 6'3", had jet black hair, looked like he had about a day-old beard, and just very hard features. He was a nice guy, and
well,
I never
did know
what his name was.
Let me say this. You know, I think, really and truly, it was kind of an unwritten sense of humor that came across, you know, that we didn't. I think it was a private joke almost, because in Detroit, we had exactly the same conditions in the federal building where we went to take the exam, and that was the very, very tall ceilings, a lot of glass windows in the room.
Yep.
You could look out, and then marble everywhere. So it was like an echo chamber, you know, so if you sat in the back of the room where I was and they gave the code test, you were really straining.
It's like, and that's where I was when I took the test.
But
actually, it took me two times to pass the test. I didn't make the code test in September. I did pass it in December. But then, if you didn't pass the code, you couldn't take the written.
Well, what they would do, though, is if you had passed your, you know, you took your paperwork up to the front and you went back and you sat down and you waited.
Mm-hmm.
And they invariably the fellow at the front, and at that point in time, it was a guy in Detroit by the name of Richard Cotton, and he would announce to the whole room, he would say, Mr. Whatever, you have failed.
And at that point, you picked up your paper and pencil and went home.
Right. And if you passed, I've talked to other people. Matter of fact, Watt Hairston will tell you the same story. They would call you to the front, and they would say, Mr. Randall, it appears you have passed.
Exactly.
Yeah, real private-like, but the guy that failed, you failed. And it sounded,
in front of the world.
Yeah, and it sounded like the voice of God in those rooms when they would say that to you. So when you said they didn't mean to be that, I'm sorry, that's why I laughed, because...
It's very well documented that they probably didn't mean to be, but they really were, because you were nervous as a cat when you went up to take that test anyway. And if the test started at 1 o'clock, everybody always got up there at 11 to make sure you weren't late and to let the nerves calm down. But invariably, you'd talk to people in the hallway outside the room, and you'd just get more nervous.
Yeah. But, I think, though, it was a different time, and I think to some degree, maybe this isn't a good thing, but there was a lot less, let's put this, there was a lot more reverence and fear of the FCC.
There was.
Than there is today. I mean, I don't even think that exists anywhere today, but you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and I went through the same thing when I passed my first class commercial license, but that's another story. But when you pass the code test, it's much different than what it was under the volunteer examiner program. You had to actually have a string of correct characters that indicated 1 minute of solid copy. It had to be 65 characters at 13 words per minute, or 20 words per minute meant you had to have 100 characters in a row. And you just handed in your copy sheet, and they would underline until they hit a mistake, and then they would break the line, and they'd go over until they'd pick up again, and then they'd go back and they would recount. But there was no comprehension test. You had to actually do the copy for 1 minute, and it was difficult. And then if you passed the code test, they would give you the written exam. If you failed the written exam, you had to start all over again the next time. There was no credit for passing the code. You had to pass the code again when you came back to take the written again. So it was a different era.
A whole different period of time, I know. And sitting down, and people say, if you could copy this amount of code, you could sit down and send it. Well, when you sit down in front of one of those examiners in a whole room full of people and you go to send, your brain does something totally different than what you're used to having it do.
And inevitably, the key that he would have much tighter spring tension on it than I was used to.
Oh, yeah.
And I would have to really struggle to do what I needed to do. And he never did make me send, a whole minute. If I sent 15 seconds and he knew I knew what I was doing, then, he would say, okay, that's enough. It was a different way of testing people. And it's amazing that so many people got through. But we studied hard. We practiced the code. We read and reread the license manual, but there were no question pools. We just had a license manual that ARRL published. I remember on the general there were 108 questions, and there were schematic diagrams, and there were formulas that you had to know and use to work out different problems involving power dissipation, resistance, voltage drop, things like that. But if you knew those 108 questions, you could pass a 50-question test. But we managed to muddle through it, and most of the people that Max and Bill taught got their upgraded licenses. And one of the reasons I decided to get into the VE program was in 1986, the program had been in existence for a little over a year. I think it started in 84, so maybe 2 years. But there was no VE testing in the Nashville area. And I had gotten my extra class license by that time, and I actually passed it in Miami, Florida, when I was on spring break. But that was 20 words a minute, same thing, send and receive, and do a 50-question test. But when we did the came to the realization that we didn't have a VE team in Nashville, and that the VE program was going to be around for a while, and that was really the only way people could upgrade. There was a group of people who decided, let's see what it'll take to put a team together. And Russ Ward, who was then WA4ZZU, myself, and two or three other people who were members of the RATS, the Radio Amateur Transmitting Society in Nashville, and the NARC, the Nashville Amateur Radio Club, got together, and we got four or five people who had extra class licenses and decided to form a team. We gave our first exam in December of 1986, and we've been testing since then. But the reason we did that was because we wanted to give back to the hobby the same way that people along the way had given to us. Max Arnold, Bill Bates. Max taught code to so many people. He was Delta Division Director and a Vice President of ARRL for many, many years. He passed away in 1982. Bill Bates passed away, I believe, in 1980. But they were so instrumental in getting so many people licensed in the Nashville area, and really the Middle Tennessee area, that we felt if they can do that for the hobby, we need to pay it forward and do the same thing to try to help other people. So that's sort of what got us interested in the program, and there have been a lot of things that have happened in the program since we did that first test on in December of 1986.
We'll be back with our guest, Butch Smith, N4TK, right after this. I'd like to talk to you for just a little bit about something that I discovered that made a major, major difference in my life and the way I felt. And that was a simple product called Metabolic. Now, I've taken vitamins all my life. I never felt that a vitamin I've ever taken has ever really done anything for me, except Metabolic. I found this vitamin put out by the Premier Micronutrient Corporation. And it's a different vitamin than I'd ever taken before. Matter of fact, it'll be a different vitamin than you've ever seen. Metabolic has all kinds of things going for it. Number one, first off, it was designed correctly, not like vitamins you buy in the supermarket or off the shelf. It's known that water-soluble micronutrients have a half-life of 4 to 6 hours, and fat-soluble constituents have a half-life of 6 to 8 hours. So it only makes sense to maintain a steady state of proper antioxidants in your body, the supplements have to be taken twice a day. There's no other way. So somebody says, this is time release. And no, let me tell you what. You want to feel the difference? You want to take a vitamin that actually makes you feel different? You need Metabolic. Now, Metabolic and another formula they make called Veterans Formula, they don't contain iron, copper, or manganese. Now, these minerals are known to interact with vitamin C, and they produce excessive free radicals if they're in your vitamin supplement. And this production of free radicals caused by this combination is in more than 95% of the commercial vitamins that you'll find on the supermarket shelf. It's exactly the opposite of what you want. In addition, these minerals, especially iron, can be dangerous, because men of all ages and women after menopause don't excrete iron in any significant amount. And that excess of iron in your system causes more free radicals. It causes what they call a free iron burden, and that interacts with chemicals such as vitamin C, uric acid, and they produce a lot of free radicals in your system, and you feel bad. Now, everybody today is under a lot of stress. I think we all are. There's no one that isn't under stress today. This is the formula you want because you will feel the difference. Absolutely, beyond a shadow of a doubt. Now, let me just say this. If you have diabetes, you understand the struggles that accompany this disease. You hear about a healthy lifestyle, weight management, healthy diet, and exercise. Now, studies are showing that proper vitamin supplementation, such as PMC's Metabolic and Veterans Formula, will give you a definite healthy lifestyle, far better than what you're experiencing right now. Now, Metabolic is the right choice because it helps get rid of the high glucose levels that have harmful effects on you from diabetes especially, as well as high blood pressure. High levels of alpha-lipoic acid decreases the possibilities of the formation of cataracts and sensory loss in hands and feet. Metabolic contains increased amounts of chromium picolinate that enhances insulin response. Metabolic contains increased levels of two forms of vitamin E that protects the outside and inside of each cell, and increased levels of L-carnitine supports a healthy nerve system. It's the right combination, all put together in one formula. Metabolic, if you're suffering from diabetes and high blood pressure, that's the formula for you. There's also the veterans formula. What you need to do is go to the website and take a look. It's pmcscience.us. That's pmcscience.us. Very simple to remember. Believe me, you take metabolic or veterans formula for 2 weeks, and you will be a different person. Take a look on the website. Go visit the website at pmcscience.us. That's pmcscience.us. We are back, and our guest is Butch Smith, N4TK, and he is with the Nashville Volunteer Examination Team. Have you kept count as to how many testing sessions you've had right now?
We would have had 4 a year. We test every 3 months, so we had 4 a year. We would have had, we began our 23rd year of testing last month, so we're somewhere just shy of 100 sessions.
That's really amazing.
Average attendance at the session runs anywhere from 10 to, we had a session high of 99 candidates in the year 2000 when the FCC did away with the code test, and a lot of people were able to upgrade to general just because they had passed the old technician exam before March of 1987, and at that point the technician exam was also the same as the written exam for the general. So if you had a technician license before March of 87, you could get an instant paper upgrade to general from technician, and we held what we called an administrative upgrade session, and we had 99 people there.
Now, you're familiar with the tests, I mean, because you actually roll up sleeves and get involved with the question pools and whatnot. Am I correct in that?
We have the opportunity to have input into the question pools, and some of the VE team members make suggestions, but typically most of the needs to be covered is in the question pools, but we have the question pools in a database that we refer to, and we have software that generates the exams. So we have obviously we have access to the exams where we actually generate our own exams here in Nashville, and they are generated randomly. And when someone comes to take a test with our session, it's not one of two or three pre-packaged tests. Every person who takes a test from the National VE team takes a different exam, because if we normally generate somewhere between 25 and 35 different exams for each element, the extra, the general, and the technician, and every one of them is different. So it's not like you can sit next to somebody taking the same exam and copy his answers. You can do that if you want to, but I'll guarantee you it's not going to help.
Well, the reason I was asking is because there's been so much rumor in regards to the difficulty of the tests in terms of what they are now and what they used to be and how everything stacks up. So let me ask you this. In your opinion, and I'm not asking for you to... to stand on this and say, I guarantee this is the way it is. But in your opinion, the technician test today, is it easier or is it more difficult than it was, say, 2 or 3 years ago or 5 years ago?
Oh, it's probably about the same as it was 2 or 3 or 5 years ago. Now, if you go back to when I took the technician in 1963, it is a little bit easier because they only cover material that's meant that you would need to operate in the technician bands, which right now would be 10 meters and above. There's no low-band antenna theory or antenna pattern questions or anything for low-band antennas. That is reserved for general and extra. But in terms of, since they split the exams in March of 1987, then you had a 50-question exam for general, which was the same as the technician, but what they did was they split it in 87, and you then had a general exam and you had a technician exam, and those went down to 35 questions apiece. So the tech exam has maintained about the same level of difficulty. Now, a lot of it is operating practice. A lot of it is basic theory, because technician, you got to remember, is now the entry level. There is no novice. And there's enough of the rules and regulations so that if you get that license, you should know the do's and don'ts of where you can and can't operate.
Okay,
it's about the same as it has been. I mean, the questions have evolved a little bit based on well, they didn't have Class E amplifiers 5 years ago on the exam. So as technology evolves, some of the questions change.
Well, okay, now, what happened was is when we were in, I can't remember where it was at, and someone was saying to David and, well, of course, Matt had already passed his general, but was saying to David, well, they're going to change the test on the general, so you'd better take it now because it's going to be a lot more difficult. And then I talked to Gordon West, and Gordon says, no. He said, it's actually easier than it was. So I've heard this conflicting opinion, and that's why I was asking you, what do you think? I mean, how do you think?
I think it's subjective. If you know the material, it's not really that much more difficult. The big thing that happens when they change exams, and they change exams on a three-year rotation, I believe it's 3 years, we just changed the extra class pool. The extra class pool just changed in July. But you always run into a couple of little glitches. You may find that there's a question on the test that seems to be okay, but then if somebody is actually taking the exam, he'll read the exam or he'll read the question, and it can actually be interpreted one of two ways, and you might have two answers that are correct. And in that case, you're supposed to choose the better of the two answers, but if you've got two correct answers, how do you determine if the answer key says it's supposed to be answer C, but answer B is also a good answer? If it's questionable, we typically go ahead and give them credit. Then we call the VEC and say, hey, look at this question. What do you think? And then the ARRL VEC, which is the group we're affiliated with, says, yes, we agree, you're right, there is a problem with that. We're going to take that question out of the pool. And they put that into a file for the exam-generating software that's called a locked-out file. That means when you go in and generate any future exams, that question will not be accessed to be on any future exam. So they try to stay on top of it. And you run into that occasionally for the first month or two after they change the pool. But it's not really that often that you do. That's really the worst thing I've run into, is when you've got a defective question that, you know, can be interpreted either way. And if there's been a rule change that invalidates a question, then they automatically pull that out of the available pool when you generate exams so that it doesn't appear and can never be asked because it's a defective question because of a rule change.
Well, I guess what I was saying, though, for the person contemplating testing, a guy thinks, so I'm going to go down. I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to try to get the general class license, okay? But he's been told it's a lot more difficult than it was months ago.
It's not.
Okay, that was what I was wondering, because you're working with the test. Now, you may not be familiar with every.
Now, here's where this may be. It may be valid to say that if you've been studying for your general test for 2 or 3 years, and you've had the general class study guide, and you've just been procrastinating and you haven't done it, but then you finally decide to buckle down and you read it, and you're pretty familiar with it, then you still don't take the test before it changes to a different exam because of the question pool, you're going to have to read the new version of the study guide, because a lot of the questions go away and a lot of new questions come in. So you'll have a steeper learning curve. So if you've been studying off and on and just have been procrastinating for the better part of a year, go ahead and take it before it changes, because you won't have to study for a new set of questions.
And is the same true as far as the extra? Is the extra, do you think the extra is more or less difficult than the former extra exam was?
Well, no, I don't think it is. I think what you get into is it's difficult only because you may have been studying for 2 years out of a question pool, and when the exam changes, you're going to have to study again because the questions are going to be different, and some of them will be more unfamiliar. Some of them will be a little bit more technical, and you've got to learn things. But in terms of the complexity of it and the difficulty, no, I don't think they're more difficult. They're just different.
There you go.
And if you've been studying a different question pool, and then all of a sudden they change to an updated question pool, you've got to start from ground zero to study a new question pool. That's where it could be more difficult.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, if a person goes out and they get the Gordon West study guide or the ARRL study guide for the general, the extra, or even the technician,
mm-hmm.
if they study those study guides, they go through those questions, and they learn the material in those books, they are not... In other words, they're not this is not any more taxing than it used to be for a person studying for the same grade of license, I guess.
No, it's not. It's just different. They will take some questions out of the pool. They'll add other questions into it based on advances in technology or rule changes, things like that. But it's not more difficult. It's just different.
Well, it has to be different because we've added all the work bands from years ago, you know.
Well, you know, there's a group of people out there that says they're not even work bands anymore. They're amateur radio bands. But if you call them a work band, you know you're referring to three specific bands that were awarded at the 1979 World Administrative Radio Conference.
I guess I'm going to have to learn how to keep my mouth shut.
So see, you're 30 years in the past when you call them work bands, but that's what everybody refers to them as, and you know what that means.
It's even worse when you have the radios you have that you work with. You say, well, this one has work bands, this one doesn't, this one has work, you know. That's really telling, don't you think, when you get into a situation like that?
It is, and that's a great example of how...
We'll be back with our guest, Butch Smith, N4TK, right after this. Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. And, you know, we talk about it, and we tell you, we say, if you want a stealth antenna that can hide in your backyard, if you want something portable that you can take with you, but you don't want to sacrifice performance with a portable antenna system, we tell you, this is the antenna. But you know what? You probably don't believe me. So here's what I suggest you do. If you've been thinking about the 2010, if you have need of a portable antenna, especially during emergency operations, if you participate in emergencies and you need something you can set up quickly and reliably and get on the air, go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. Don't even listen to what we're telling you. Don't pay any attention to what I say. Just go to EHAM and read the reviews. If you're thinking about a portable antenna, if you want something you can take with you on vacation, something that's attractive, that doesn't look like a bunch of poles sticking in 16 different directions, or a fishing pole hung over a tree limb or something, if you want something professional looking, something that's neat, easy, simple, but yet still performs, this is the antenna for you. Now, once again, don't take our word for it. Go to transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. Go to that site, read what's up there, and then check out the reviews, see what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you.
This is Glenn Hauser with World of Radio.
If you love ham radio, here's something you need to know about. It's the world's foremost information program on radio, and especially shortwave radio. Glenn Hauser has had a lifelong love affair with radio and shortwave listening. Have you ever wondered where all those signals are coming from up and down the radio spectrum? Listen for World of Radio with Glenn Hauser each week. By far the most interesting radio show about radio ever to hit the air.
Many new season times and frequencies, some collisions, including Afghanistan, Alaska, Burma, Greece, Lithuania, Pakistan, Russia, South Africa, Thailand, Turkey, Ukraine. Cutback in Fire Drake, Costa Rica frequencies fixed. Radio Republica disappears. Clandestines for Ethiopia. Shake up at Voice of Russia. And the propagation outlook.
Glenn Hauser meticulously documents and explains the latest propagation, signals, news, programming information, in intricate detail. World of Radio can be heard on a number of the best shortwave stations around the world. World of Radio is also available for download or as a stream from the World of Radio website each week. Download the detailed World of Radio reports with in-depth information all about the World of Radio. Get a complete listing from worldofradio.com. World of Radio is listener supported, so be sure and check out how you can participate in supporting this comprehensive service to all radio amateurs, radio and shortwave listeners. If you are a radio amateur or radio enthusiast, you will simply love World of Radio. That's worldofradio.com. We are back, and our guest is Butch Smith, N4TK, and he is with the Nashville Volunteer Examination Team.
You know, the rules change, and that necessitates changes in the question pools, because you have administrative changes because of rule changes. You have technology changes when you add things like Class E amplifiers. When I took the exam, you had Class A, A, B1, B, and C, and that was it. And it's sort of interesting. You're asking about the complexity. With an extra class license, I'm supposed to know all there is to know, or at least that's what the FCC thinks. When we get a new question pool, I don't care if it's technician, general, or extra, I will sit and take an interactive exam that's generated by the software. I can take it on my computer. And I don't score perfectly, and a lot of the things I don't score perfectly on are things that I don't use every day or things that I don't run into or I'm not familiar with, and I don't study before I take it. I just take it cold when we get a new question pool. And sometimes it's quite sobering to do that, and a lot of the VEs on our team try to just keep up and see how they're doing that way.
You know,
it's quite sobering sometimes to do that.
I think, too, and it's too much to expect for an individual to go down to a testing center and pass a test they have not studied for. I mean, that's just...
It usually does not happen, but one of the things that is really encouraging, and we try to do this, if we have people come in who take a technician test, which is the entry-level test, and they pass, and they may pass with a perfect score. A lot of people pass with perfect scores because they study, and if they study and understand the material and it's taught well by a teacher, they'll make a very good score. We will offer them, as we're allowed to do under the rules, the opportunity to take the next higher class test, which would be general in this case. And probably 20%, 25% of the time, they will either pass or come so close that they'll say, I'd like to take it again and try one more time. Of course, they have to pay an additional test fee under ARRL. But if they get within one question, we'll let them take it again. And they have to pay an additional test fee. But we've had people walk in with nothing and walk out with an extra class license in one day.
And I can understand that, because...
Now, it takes a very special type person who has done that. And they have to be fairly knowledgeable about radio theory, and they have to have a pretty good knowledge of, or an adequate knowledge of rules and regulations.
But I can understand how that would happen, because there are some folks that are just very studious, and
there are
they have the aptitude to study and absorb the material, and it would be nothing for them. Now, I'm not saying me to go through and study the technician study guide, the general study guide, and the extra study guide.
But most people are coming there just to get that technician license for the first time. We give them a free shot, and I tell them, this is a free look at the general, and you know you might pass it. And we usually have one person out of 15 or 20 who will actually take it and pass it, even though they didn't specifically study for it.
Now that
can backfire on you.
Okay.
Because if you encourage someone to take it and they really don't feel good about it, they've just come out and they scored a perfect score on the technician, and they take the general, and they get, they have to have 26 questions to pass the general, and they get 12 right. They leave very discouraged and dejected, thinking, I have failed, when in reality they haven't. They got a free look at the test, and they walked out with a technician license. But you have to be very careful about not over-encouraging or overselling the idea of taking one you haven't studied for.
Yeah, and I guess I could see that. But the average person on the street that does not have a technical background, that's intrigued by ham radio and they want to get started into ham radio, when they look at that general class, if they haven't studied at all, they might as well be looking at a book on Egyptian, you know, because...
If they don't have a good background in radio, RF, or electronics, you're exactly right. But see, we don't, when we see the candidates, we don't know what their backgrounds are. They can refuse, and a lot of them do. But we don't ever prejudge whether somebody is capable of taking it and passing it or not passing it. But we have to be careful not to force somebody or make someone feel they really have to take it when they don't want to.
We'll be back with our guest, Butch Smith, N4TK, right after this.
Brand new from Transworld Antennas, it's the 4040, the 40-meter monoband antenna. Now, you heard us talking about this a little earlier. That's the Transworld Adventurer 4040 monoband antenna. It's the perfect antenna for high-performance DX communications in a portable stealth package. This antenna system is ideal for camping, emergencies, or permanent installations, and the 4040 switching array box covers the entire 40-meter band 7.0 to 7.3 without the necessity of either manual band changing or the need for a controller. Now listen to this. If you already own a TW2010 Adventurer or Backpacker antenna and you want to use the antenna on 40 meters, you can get the Transworld Adventurer 4040 array box in center section only, right now only $139.95. That puts you on 40 meters, and you're dealing with the exact same antenna structure that has made the TW2010 Transworld Adventurer so famous. The black powder coating, the stealth, the way the antenna is able to hide, and in addition to that, it's portable if you want to take it with you. Of course, you can get it with a deluxe travel bag. It's just fantastic. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. If you can't remember Transworld Antennas, just remember to go to our website at QSO, tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, and click on the link for Transworld Antennas. Take a look at this brand new Adventurer 4040.
Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld Antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. And, you know, we talk about it, and we tell you, we say, if you want a stealth antenna that can hide in your backyard, if you want something portable that you can take with you, but you don't want to sacrifice performance with a portable antenna system, we tell you this is the antenna. But you know what? You probably don't believe me. So here's what I suggest you do. If you've been thinking about the 2010, if you have need of a portable antenna, especially during emergency operations, if you participate in emergencies and you need something you can set up quickly and reliably and get on the air, go to eHam and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to eHam and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the eHam reviews, or you can just go to eHam yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to eHam on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. Don't even listen to what we're telling you. Don't pay any attention to what I say. Just go to eHam and read the reviews. If you're thinking about a portable antenna, if you want something you can take with you on vacation, something that's attractive, that doesn't look like a bunch of poles sticking in 16 different directions, or a fishing pole hung over a tree limb or something, if you want something professional looking, something that's neat, easy, simple, but yet still performs, this is the antenna for you. But once again, don't take our word for it.
Go to transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. Go to that site, read what's up there, and then check out the reviews, see what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. We are back, and our guest is Butch Smith, N4TK, and he is with the Nashville Volunteer Examination Team. Okay, now you see people come in, and you see people sit down, take the test. You see the ones that pass and the ones that fail. And I'm sure that your team has the you probably hold conversation. You talk to folks, because I can't imagine you not, you know, you folks are going to encourage them to the maximum and whatnot, so that nobody leaves discouraged. But my question is, you've made observations. Now, what do you find the common thread in the successful passing of the test when you talk to folks about how they studied, what they studied, and how they went about it?
The people that inevitably pass and have the highest scores and actually complete the exams in the shortest amount of time are the people who have taken a class that's been taught by another amateur for that particular exam element. And they have conscientiously worked at it, and they have been elmored by both the instructor and other people in the class who help them study, and they get into discussion groups. But they study. They work at it. They see it as a challenge, and they rise to it. They study the material, and they learn a little bit of it rather than just memorizing it. Those are the ones that do the best. Well, now, we had a gentleman come in, and he was a retired professor of electrical engineering at Tennessee Tech University in Cookeville. He had no ham license, but he was a retired Navy telegraph operator. This was back when you had to take code tests as well. He passed 20 words a minute with perfect copy. He took the novice, he passed it. We offered him the tech, he passed it. We offered him the general, he took a little bit longer, but he passed it. He took the advanced, which at that time was pretty stiff, and it took him even longer. But at this point, he'd gotten our attention. Here's somebody who walked in with nothing, and he's taking 5 written exams, and he just passed 20 words a minute. I started looking at his papers, and he needed on the advanced test to come up with a formula to solve one of the problems. He didn't know that formula, but he wrote on his scratch paper 2 other formulas he knew, and he derived the formula he needed from 2 formulas he did know. That's knowing the material. And he went on and passed his extra, walked out with an extra class license after coming in with nothing. That guy took longer to do it, but he scored perfect score all the way through.
That's amazing. Well, you know, talk about knowing the material. Something very, very interesting. I'm going to tell a story here. Probably I'm going to get in trouble. So you'll help me out, though, won't you, if I get in trouble?
Oh, absolutely. You know me.
Well, I got into it. My son, Matt, passed the general.
Right.
And we got into a discussion the other day about something. He had no idea what a beat frequency oscillator was.
He's not old enough.
And it hit me all of a sudden. I thought, wow, things really have changed. You know, they really have changed. Is it necessary for someone to understand and know what a beat frequency oscillator is? And
not I guess to pass the test.
I guess not. You know, I mean,
my first receiver was a night, other than the one that my grandfather had, was a night kit span master. And you had to turn the BFO on to be able to hear code. And that's how I learned what a BFO was.
Well, you know, and
that was back in the 60s.
And would you not say that as far as knowing his stuff, Matt is probably a bit over average?
I think Matt is very, I know Matt, and I think, yes, he's above average. Now, the thing is, technology changes. Does he need to know what a BFO is? No. And the FCC has said, you don't need to know code to pass a test and become a licensed amateur radio operator. And the hobby evolves, and I will say this to the people, and I may get in trouble here. If the hobby doesn't evolve, it will lose in the long run, because people will not want to learn code. People will not want to learn about a beat frequency oscillator. They will not want to learn about a triode, a diode, a pentode, a heptode, which are tubes. A lot of people don't even know what tubes are. And they don't need to be good amateur radio operators.
We'll be back with our guest, Butch Smith, N4TK, right after this.
If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. This antenna features a specially designed lighter weight stand, and its unique slot design eliminates the need for a controller box and cable. The exact same performance as the famous TW2010 Adventurer. If you've heard you can't take it with you when you go, don't believe it. The Trans World TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. All other shipping will be through U.S. Postal Service at actual cost. Go to the website, take a look at the Trans World TW2010L Backpacker Antenna at transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email, because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. We are back, and our guest is Butch Smith, N4TK, and he is with the Nashville Volunteer Examination Team.
And to attract people into this hobby, we need to keep it up to date. We need to keep it interesting and challenging and make people want to come and join the hobby for all of the fun, education, and entertainment they can get out of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's interesting, because in talking to, when we were in Huntsville and we did the live broadcast, we were, as you saw, we were right next, our booth was right next to Vibraplex.
Uh-huh.
And the folks there were telling me, they said, now that they've done away with the code, their business at Vibraplex had increased. It had gone up.
It's very interesting. We don't give code tests anymore, obviously, because they're not required. However, we've had a lot of requests, and we talked about it as a team, and we may start doing this, to begin giving tests again. They wouldn't get you anything except a piece of paper from the Nashville VE team saying that you passed a 5-word-a-minute, 13-word-a-minute, or 20-word-a-minute code test.
I think a proficiency certificate in CW would be something that any ham would be proud to hang on their wall. I really believe that. I think that that's...
You think that, and I think that, and I've got an extra class license hanging on my wall in the shack, and it says, because of the date on it, that I passed 20 words a minute, and I think that's great. But I know people who are just every bit as good and even better than I am in ham radio, who can't even tell me what an A, a B, a C, or a D is in Morse code. But they have other strengths that make up for that. And one of the things that has divided ham radio and has been a very divisive thing, there are two things I think that have divided ham radio. One was the incentive licensing program back in the 1960s. That really caused a rift when the FCC took away frequencies from the generals and advance and gave them to extras. That caused a real problem, and it was a PR nightmare for ARRL. The other one has been the concept that if you don't know code, you're not a ham. And I have heard very uncomplimentary descriptions of people who have the new codeless licenses. Back when they offered the no-code technician license, there were some very unkind words said about people who entered ham radio without passing a code test. And you remember, if you remember, there were two types of technicians, technician as a no-code or technician, and you'd pass 5 words a minute. And if you had passed 5 words a minute, you could actually work on the low bands on CW. But the world changed the way they look at it. The ITU changed, and they dropped the code requirements internationally. And a lot of countries followed suit immediately. The U.S., it took a little while. But now there's no code requirement to operate on any frequency anywhere. And that, I think, is good, because code is a beautiful way to communicate. There are times when code can get through when no other form can, that you can easily access other than some of the digital things. And not everybody has a computer there to generate and receive PSK31, for example. But if you have an elementary transmitter and you turn it on and off and send a series of dots and dashes, that'll get through when voice won't. And it's a great thing to know, but you don't have to know it. And I think the people that say you're not a real ham if you don't know code are really doing a disservice to the hobby, and it's becoming a divisive thing. And that may upset some people who listen to this, and you've got to remember, that's my opinion. It's not the Nashville VE team's opinion. It's not the ARRL's opinion. It is N4TK's opinion.
Well, I've heard some folks on the air make some very unflattering remarks and say, that guy, well, he's one of those no-code generals. And I guess my question to those guys would be, the no-code general fella, he may have a whole lot of skills.
The no-code general fella is the guy that comes up with the concept of a communication mode called PSK31 or any of these others that will do wonderful things, or APRS development and deployment. And, you know, that's inherently more interesting to the new generation of potential hams than the dashes and dots of CW. If we don't get more people into the hobby, the federal government can start looking at, and by the federal government, I mean the people that want our spectrum space, can start looking at the amount of spectrum we have as hams, look at the number of people in the country that use that spectrum, and say, this country would be better served to take those frequencies away from this group and redeploy them to the wireless companies, the cellular companies, the satellite companies, anybody that, you know, needs them, because I'd rather give these frequencies to 30 million people than to 300,000. And that's what we have to watch out for as ham radio operators.
Well, yeah, and I'll tell you something. I hear people talk about this, and boy, I'll tell you, you know as well as I do, because we both work in the communications business, that I've heard people comment about this kind of almost arrogantly, as if, you know, that the ham radio frequencies, amateur radio frequencies, are a protected thing, and you really just don't have to worry about that. And I think that's just foolhardy. I think, yeah, there's a lot of people out there in the data services.
Look at 220 megahertz and what happened there.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a lot of folks out there. The HF spectrum is in high demand for data transmission. There are people that would love to get their hands on the HF spectrum. Our guest is Butch Smith, N4TK, and he's with the Nashville Volunteer Examination Team. We're going to be back with Butch right after this, but we're going to take a little break right now for station identification. Brand new from Transworld Antennas, it's the 4040, the 40-meter monoband antenna. Now, you heard us talking about this a little earlier. That's the Transworld Adventurer 4040 monoband antenna. It's the perfect antenna for high-performance DX communications in a portable stealth package. This antenna system is ideal for camping, emergencies, or permanent installations, and the 4040 switching array box covers the entire 40-meter band 7.0 to 7.3 without the necessity of either manual band changing or the need for a controller. Now listen to this. If you already own a TW2010 Adventurer or Backpacker antenna, and you want to use the antenna on 40 meters, you can get the Transworld Adventurer 4040 array box in center section only, right now only $139.95. That puts you on 40 meters, and you're dealing with the exact same antenna structure that has made the TW2010 Transworld Adventurer so famous. The black powder coating, the stealth, the way the antenna is able to hide. And in addition to that, it's portable if you want to take it with you. Of course, you can get it with a deluxe travel bag. It's just fantastic. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. If you can't remember Transworld Antennas, just remember to go to our website at QSO, tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, and click on the link for Transworld Antennas. Take a look at this brand new Adventurer 4040.
We hear us talk about Transworld Antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. And, you know, we talk about it, and we tell you, we say, if you want a stealth antenna that can hide in your backyard, if you want something portable that you can take with you, but you don't want to sacrifice performance with a portable antenna system, we tell you this is the antenna. But you know what? You probably don't believe me. So here's what I suggest you do. If you've been thinking about the 2010, if you have need of a portable antenna, especially during emergency operations, if you participate in emergencies and you need something you can set up quickly and reliably and get on the air, go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. Don't even listen to what we're telling you. Don't pay any attention to what I say. Just go to EHAM and read the reviews. If you're thinking about a portable antenna, if you want something you can take with you on vacation, something that's attractive, that doesn't look like a bunch of poles sticking in 16 different directions, or a fishing pole hung over a tree limb or something, if you want something professional looking, something that's neat, easy, simple, but yet still performs, this is the antenna for you. Now, once again, don't take our word for it. Go to transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. Go to that site, read what's up there, and then check out the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you.
We are back, and our guest is Butch Smith, N4TK, and he is with the Nashville Volunteer Examination Team.
And so I agree totally, completely with you in this. I think this is something we have to be very vigilant about, and we have to be able to prove our worth all the time. I mean, and if we can't, we're being remiss. We're the ones that's going to drop the ball.
There was a VE team in the Tennessee area, the Middle Tennessee area, that quit giving exams when they came out with the no-code technician license because they felt that the hobby was deteriorating past the point where they could deal with it. I think that was short-sighted, and I'm sorry they did that. That did increase the number of people that we started getting at the Nashville VE team sessions, and that has been very good for us. I'm just sorry that the other group decided to drop out.
You know, and I don't want to, you're a good fellow to discuss this with, and this is a subject that I've wanted to talk about a little bit, but I want to be careful who I talk about it with over the radio here, folks. And that is another thing that we have to be careful about in terms of the unflattering things that take place on the air on ham radio at times. And, you know, we've got lots of radio amateurs listening to this show. And I don't mean to pick on anybody, but, you know, sometimes I wonder if we shouldn't have some classes in manners, you know.
You can't fix stupid.
That's true.
I've been told. And the arrogance and entitlement mentalities of I'm entitled to say anything I can't want to because it's free speech. Just because you can say something about somebody doesn't mean you should. And I may be a dinosaur here, but I think that discretion on how you act on the air and how you behave yourself and how you treat others is very important, not only for the relationships that you have with whoever you're talking to, but if you're talking to two or three people on the air, there may be 50 people listening to that conversation, and you don't want the people listening to that conversation to come up with the wrong impression of what ham radio is. You may have somebody out there who's potentially going to be a good ham, and if he hears a bunch of profanity or a bunch of sarcasm that's unwarranted or slurs of any type, he's going to say, you know, I don't need this, and he's going to go away, and ham radio will have lost potentially a very good future ham.
Well, you know, but it's not just that. And we know from being on shortwave radio, I don't think folks realize how many millions, and I'm not talking thousands, how many millions of people tune in and listen to shortwave. A lot of these folks have receivers and listen to the ham bands. Some of them may never aspire to have a ham license. But their word of mouth about the hobby to people that they know, and there's a lot of people, I will say this, there are scads of people on an international level who have a very, very wide center of influence. And I'm talking about throughout governments, in business, in a lot of different areas. You have, like you said, you have no idea who's listening to you.
You never do.
You know, when you put out that CQ or you answer someone, you join a roundtable discussion, whatever, you have absolutely no idea who you're impacting. And so if we all conduct ourselves well, we speak for the hobby, and I think we help propagate the hobby. We carry it to another level. The other thing is, too, in regards to amateur radio, you know, I think that you'll see certain amateurs that seem to always have someone calling them. There's always somebody saying hello to them. There's always somebody saying, man, I haven't heard you in a long time. How you been getting along? And I think sometimes maybe some of the other fellows get a little envious of them because they're popular. You know, they're sought out. And I think that if instead of taking offense to that, because maybe nobody wants to talk to you, you know, it might do well to look at those people and how they conduct themselves on the air. And what is it that makes that ham in demand? Why is it that everyone wants to talk to him? Why does everybody want his call sign in their log?
It's not because he conducts himself poorly on the air.
You know, and I guess the other thing, too, and I have one thing I've noticed, and that is that the QSOs where a ham comes on the frequency and immediately it's not about them. They immediately start talking to the other person and they ask, well, how are you? How's your family? You know, and if they don't know the other amateur, they start asking some questions. And something that really impressed the daylights out of me and my crew, we went to visit the fellow that demonstrated ham radio to me. The first time I ever saw an amateur radio station in progress was a fellow by the name of Nelson Cosby. Lives up in Dearborn, Michigan, and I was just a little kid. And he said something while he demonstrated. I went in, he had a Heathkit Marauder, and he had a
an SX-101 receiver and a four-element 20-meter beam and a home.
I know what those radios are. That dates me, too.
He had a well, I did an interview with him, and he was up on the website. I had pictures of his shack. He still has the power supply of the original 813 amplifier that he was using to make this first 20-meter contact I'd ever seen. He had a pair of 813s, and he had the power supply very neatly built into a bookcase with a glass front on it. It was impressive. And he said to me, he said, the thing that fascinates me the most when I'm talking to people, he says, I like to ask them what their profession is, what they do for a living. And this included amateurs from all over the world. And he found that just so fascinating to ask them questions about their profession and their family. And this fellow was never starved for a QSO. When people heard his call sign on the air, they immediately would say hello to Nelson Cosby.
More often than not, if you ask the other fellow what he does or what his interests are, you'll find a big parallel and a lot of common ground. And that just sparks more interesting conversation topics with that person.
Well, you know, you're really involved in the VE team here, and there's folks all over the country that could get involved. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is you told me, you said, Ted, I want you to see this. I want you to see this in operation. Because
all
when
right.
when you're talking about this, you have in your voice a spark. You know, you're seeing some magic there.
Our team started out with five people. We have 35 members of the Nashville VE team right now. I looked at the roster right before we started this conversation. We have 35 active members. Everybody doesn't come to every session, but there is a lot of interest, and we have a lot of people there. But one of the things that we do is if someone passes an extra class test with us, we will encourage them to become a VE. And through attrition, we lose some of our members through job moves or some people pass away, and that's very unfortunate. But we've grown to 35 people, and it's a lot more fun to give the tests than it is to take them. And one of the reasons it's more fun to give the tests is you see this person come in, they're nervous, you try to calm them down. I don't ever want to be perceived as where the FCC was to me when I was taking tests, and I know how it was for you. We encourage them. We make it as informal as we can. We get up and we try to go over the ground rules, no smoking in the building, blah, blah, blah. And then I'll say, do you have any questions? Does anybody have any questions? And there may be one or two, but I always ask it again. Does anyone have any questions? Well, nobody raises their hand, so I'll say, okay, if you have no questions, that means you have to have all the answers, and you will pass the test, and we'll have 100% pass rate. Everybody laughs then, and that takes the edge off of it. I use that line every week or every test session. I know the rest of the team gets tired of hearing it because they hear it a lot, but it does tend to calm people down, and it really is a good tension reliever. Then, when we're sitting out there at the paperwork processing desk where we actually fill out the paperwork when they have passed their exams, and they come out with a VE leading them down the hall to where we're doing the final paperwork, they'll be grinning from ear to ear, and you can always tell they've passed. And to be able to see that magic look in someone's eye that I have achieved this goal, I have passed this exam, I am now a ham radio operator, is just something that's indescribable. That is enough payback to us for all the time and effort we put into preparing the exams, generating the exams, printing them out, sorting them in folders, doing everything we do. And then you see these people that are so happy that they have passed, whether they passed by one question or passed with a perfect score. And if somebody comes out and says, how many did I miss? And I'll say, oh, you missed five, or you missed three, or you got a perfect score. I always say, nobody ever asks you what your score was. They just know that you're a tech, you're a general, or you're an extra. So your score doesn't matter. You passed. And to see the look in their eyes is just something you cannot imagine until you've seen it firsthand.
How would you suggest, or what suggestion would you make for folks that want to get involved in VE testing, and they're not necessarily, obviously, they're all the folks that are listening to this program are not located in Tennessee. So in all the different areas of the country...
You can go... We're affiliated with ARRL, but there are, I think, 19 or 20 or somewhere in the vicinity of 20, maybe 25, and I don't know the exact number, of VECs. A VEC is a volunteer examination coordinator. The VE teams work for the VECs. You can go online, I know, to W5YI. You can go to ARRL, and I'm sure that every other VEC has a website you can go to. And you can probably Google VEC, but if you want to, you can go to ARRL, for example. I'm more familiar with that than I am the others, since that's our parent organization. And you can look for exams in your area. You can do an examination search. If there's an examination team in your city and you're not aware of it, call somebody up on the VE team. They list contact people and ask if you could, you know, talk to them about becoming a VE. You can become a VE as a general, or you can become a VE as an extra. Or if you have an advanced class license, you can become a VE. Of course, they don't give that exam anymore. But advanced class operators are grandfathered for that class as long as they keep renewing their license. If you don't have a testing team in your area, then decide whether you would like to become affiliated with one of the ones that offers VE testing. ARRL is one, W5YI is another, and I know a lot of regional ones. I'm not familiar with ones across the country. But find a website, talk to a ham, see how people in your town are getting licensed. Where do they go to take tests? And if you want to start a VE team in your city or in your area, talk to one of the VECs. You will have to pass a short exam that shows you know what is expected of a volunteer examiner and what the rules are. With ARRL, it is an open book test. But they just want to make sure you have read the material and you understand it and you know what your responsibilities and obligations are. You must be 18 years of old because you're signing legal documents that are certifying certain facts. But other than that and the licensing, anyone can become a VE. And if you can find someone who is an experienced VE in your area, let them mentor you through your first few sessions. Or better yet, go to one session, even if you have to drive 50 miles, to watch how they do it. Seeing how somebody else overcomes all the problems is invaluable when you face those problems in your own session.
We'll be back with our guest, Butch Smith, N4TK, right after this.
As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO.
If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. This antenna features a specially designed lighter weight stand, and its unique slot design eliminates the need for a controller box and cable. The exact same performance as the famous TW2010 Adventurer. If you've heard you can't take it with you when you go, don't believe it. The Transworld TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. All other shipping will be through U.S. Postal Service at actual cost. Go to the website, take a look at the Transworld TW2010L Backpacker Antenna at transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
We are back, and our guest is Butch Smith, N4TK, and he is with the Nashville Volunteer Examination Team. I want to kind of shift gears here just a little bit. Don't want to get too far off the beaten path, but as far as amateur radio is concerned, how do you feel that ham radio has played a role in your professional career?
I went into engineering in college. I'm an electrical engineer. I helped revive the ham radio club at the school I went to, which was Vanderbilt here in Nashville. It has taught me a lot of practical, hands-on experience and facts that a lot of graduating EEs did not know. Sad to say, there are people who go through electrical engineering programs in some areas that don't, they understand all the theoretical knowledge, they don't understand practical applications of that knowledge. At one point back in the 60s and 70s, there were schools graduating electrical engineers who could not look at a resistor or a capacitor and tell you which was which. They couldn't read the color codes on a resistor. They probably didn't need to. I find that the more practical hands-on knowledge you have, the better off you are, and that has helped me in my professional career as a broadcast television engineer and engineering consultant, because a lot of times I wound up doing hands-on equipment repair, configuration, or whatever. And without the knowledge that I've gotten through amateur radio, I would not be able to be nearly as proficient as I am in my chosen career.
I'd like for you to kind of share with a listening audience a little bit about your professional line of work, the company that you have, and the things that you folks are involved in and the things you do. For example, I know you were very heavily involved in the presidential debate here in Nashville over at Belmont, and I'd like for you to share that with folks, because I think with younger people, especially folks that are aspiring to get into ham radio, I think that especially you're the way you look at things, the way you visualize, the way you problem solve, all these things, I think, have been enhanced by your ham radio experience. And I think that sharing a little of this would be encouraging to a lot of folks, if you would be so kind. I don't want to put you on the spot, but you're really an example.
Well, as a ham, I've had to solve a lot of problems in my career. It's TVI, or I can't make contacts, or I got a QSL card from a member of our VE team now who said, when I was a novice, I was copying you better on 14 megahertz than I was on 7 megahertz. Oops, second harmonic, bingo, that taught me something right there. And I brought that QSL card to a testing session about a year ago and showed it to the rest of the team, and boy, did I take a lot of ribbing for that. But that taught me something. And all the stuff I've learned on how to troubleshoot in ham radio has affected my ability to troubleshoot in the television industry. I started working for a local television station in 1968 while I was still in Vanderbilt. I did that to get money to help go to school and finish my degree. When I graduated, the TV station I was working for part-time made me an offer to stay, and I did. Worked there 7 more years, then I went and worked at another company, which became the Nashville Network and Country Music Television. Then, in 2001, those companies were bought by Viacom, and the operations were moved to New York from Nashville, and about 450 of us were given opportunities to start new careers. Well, I was 53 years old, and nobody would hire me, so I decided to hire myself, and we started a broadcast engineering consulting company. And since we had done a lot of digital work at the Nashville Network, I was able to work with television stations in the transition from analog to digital. And I laughingly say what we do at MBITS, which is Media Broadcast Integration and Technical Services, is teach people how to spell HDTV. And that sounds funny, but a lot of people, it's not intrinsic and inherently obvious how DTV works. And we are still learning a lot of things about digital television, even as we have worked in the last month, things that happened for no apparent reason, and it's an evolving technology. But the troubleshooting methods and the discipline that I had to learn in ham radio, unlike if I want to be heard on 20 meters, I have to make sure that my antenna is efficiently radiating. And how do I make sure of that? I look at my SWR, I check the IR losses, the resistance losses in my coax, I make sure I have a good ground system. All those things have helped me to work first in analog TV and then in digital TV. And basically, you troubleshoot and you follow a set pattern like a mental flow chart. I have the signal here, I don't have the signal here, or the signal is good here, the signal is bad here, what's happening in between, what can I do to make it better and fix the problem. And I've gotten a lot of that from ham radio, because with ham radio, you have to fix your own stuff. You have to, and that doesn't mean nobody can help you, but you learn how to consult with other hams or consult with other engineers in my profession and come up with a solution that you may or may not have been able to come up with on your own, but use logical methods to arrive at that solution.
Well, you know, the other thing, too, and we were talking earlier, we talked about CW and the changing technologies in amateur radio and how ham radio has to evolve. It has to move along, and it has to embrace new technologies. Not that it has to forget the old, but it has to be able to work with and understand the new. In the broadcasting business, what would happen if you did not embrace the new technologies and did not make it your business to be on top of that business?
We would be out of business if we did not do that, because, as you know, and a lot of your listeners may know, here in the United States, on February 17th, 2009, analog television broadcasting, as we know it, ceases to exist for high-powered television stations. And if you can't spell DTV, you're going to have to pay a lot of money to somebody who can to keep your TV station on the air. One of the things we try to do is train staffs so that they can take care of their own facilities and consult with us if they need to, but there aren't enough people in our company to go around and serve everybody. We try to share that knowledge and broaden the knowledge base among our clients so they can do their own troubleshooting and come to us only when they run into major problems. But everyone has to embrace the change from analog to digital, just like when spark gap transmitters went away. If you continued to broadcast with a spark gap transmitter, you would disrupt communications for 20 megahertz wide over a wide geographic area on the low bands, and the FCC would come and probably throw you under the jail. That's another great example of how technology has been legislated out of existence, just like analog television. Terrestrially broadcast analog TV will be legislated out of existence in February 2009, just as spark gap transmitters were banned by the FCC many, many decades ago.
Well, you know, even in the radio business, and I don't know how many people realize this,
but you know, I still enjoy messing around with old analog tape machines. But you couldn't seriously depend on an analog tape machine inside of a radio station to record on, edit, and do all the things that we do today. It would be maddening to try to incorporate that into a modern-day radio station.
One of the things you'd run into also is you can't find replacement or repair parts to keep the equipment running.
Well, that's true as well. That's true.
Then you wind up having to resort to what I call dumpster diving to keep your equipment working. And then after a while, even the dumpsters don't offer you any solutions.
Well, you know, I can go back to the days in radio where a radio show like this was produced on a reel-to-reel machine.
I remember that.
And we had splicing blocks, and we had grease pencils, and we had very sharp razor blades, and we would wind up with miles and miles of tape on the floor when we were done.
I remember when videotape editing was done by putting a magnetic solution on the recorded videotape and looking at where the frame pulses were that defined where you could actually cut the physical videotape and splice it so that the picture wouldn't jump.
You know, but it would be so horrible.
That's how they edited Laugh In.
Yeah.
Physical splicing.
Well, you know, but it would be so horrible to continue to embrace that technology with a religious fervor and have a contempt for the new stuff. I mean, it's just not healthy.
But if you enjoy doing that and you're good at doing that, that's fine. And I'll give you a great example. 2-inch quadruplex videotape. It's what we used back in the very late 50s and through the 60s and 70s and somewhat into the 80s. That technology has gone away for all commercial application. However, there is a plethora of material that is archival material still recorded on 2-inch tape sitting on the shelves in people's vaults. And the only way to get that material off and into another medium, such as onto a server or something, is to be able to play that back on a 2-inch videotape machine. So embracing the technology to keep that old 2-inch videotape machine or that old analog audio tape machine that you were speaking of still working in order to recover archival material is not so crazy as it sounds. There's still a need for it.
Well, you know, the same holds true with vinyl records.
Exactly.
And I happen to own a state-of-the-art a high-end hi-fi turntable and cartridge and tone arm, and there's music that's old that you want to preserve, and that's about the only way to do it because you can't find it anywhere any other way. So, but it's still going to wind up on a CD or on a hard drive before it's over.
It'll wind up there, and eventually, I mean, the same thing goes back to you know, if you look at photographs of battle scenes and battlegrounds and things that were going on during the Civil War. Those were preserved on old photographic paper, which is deteriorating because of high acid contents, and you've got to get that off of that and into another medium that will survive. And being able to hang on to the technology to work on the analog audio tape machine or the analog videotape machine in order to recover archival material is great. It's only when you make that your only focus and you totally put down the evolvement of technology that you really start becoming counterproductive to where you need to be.
Yeah, you know, and another good example of that in amateur radio is the use of AM today. And I enjoy tuning around and hearing some of these AM guys talk. They really are into it. I mean, they're building up PDM solid-state homebrew transmitters, and it's amazing to watch them preserve that particular mode of communication, and I hand them my hat and say, hey, this is great. You know,
until we get to a point where the bandwidth requirements of AM become counterproductive to the existence of ham radio, I think it's great, too.
And I don't know if you remember, but there was quite a war that went on when single sideband was introduced.
I remember that. I had a Johnson Viking Ranger 2 that was AM, and I didn't have a single sideband transmitter for a long time.
And they referred to sideband as slop bucket.
Single slop bucket. bucket.
Yeah. Well, I want to cover one more thing with you, and that is this. I'd like to talk just a little bit, because I think this all goes hand in hand, about the American Radio Relay League. Because I think, you know, one of the things that we're remiss, a lot of hams have been members of the league. Some of them have dropped memberships, not necessarily intentionally, but I mean, just as time goes on, you either forget to renew the membership, or some folks actually just get crossways with the league for one reason or another. But, you know, it's such an integral part of this hobby, especially if you go back and you consider the heritage of the hobby. And I think one of my favorite people of all time has got to be Hiram Percy Maxim. And I think the thing that really has captured me about him was his sense of humor. And he really had one. At league headquarters today, I understand there's an award that's sitting in the shelf waiting for the first radio amateur that contacts Mars. Okay. And this was all, along with the wolf hung and the ready snitch and all these things, were all a product of his mind. But tell me a little bit about your involvement and your appreciation of the ARRL.
When I got my first license in 1962, I didn't know many of the hams in Nashville, but I did what most people should do today. If you get a license, look up another member of the community who is a ham. Talk to them. Is there a local ham club you can join? In 1962, I joined a local ham club. I met Max Arnold and Bill Bates, that we referred to earlier. They were two very, very dear Elmers for me when I started my upgrade path. And Max encouraged me to become a member of the ARRL. I joined in September of 1962. I guess that would mean I have been a member of ARRL for 46 years. In 1966, I believe, or 67, sometime in the mid-60s, they came out with the lifetime membership option. Well, shoot, I was 18 years old, and it was 20 times the dues, which was like $8 or $10 or something like that, and that was a lot of money back then. And I decided to become a life member at Max's behest and encouragement and threats and every other thing. And I did it over a period of time because 18-year-olds don't have a lot of discretionary money. And besides, you'd rather spend it on ham equipment than ARRL, or at least when you're 18 years old, you had. So for the great sum of somewhere between $160 and $200 back in the 1960s, I became a life member. I think I have gotten my money's worth. ARRL has done a lot for ham radio. They have not been able to stay out of the spotlight of controversy. As we spoke about earlier, the incentive licensing that was really endorsed by ARRL and promoted really divided the ham community. There are a lot of people who blame ARRL for a lot of things. If you stop and look at the good that the league has done, they are the one national voice that we have for ham radio. BPL technology, broadband over power lines, is an evolving technology that uses existing power grid electric lines to distribute data for internet, high-speed internet accessibility for a large portion of the population, or at least that's the theory. In reality, these lines that are strung between telephone poles become great antennas and radiators of signals that you don't really want to hear, and they interfere with the ham bands, tremendous interference potential. The league has fought BPL deployment where it has become a thorn in the side of hams and has caused so much interference that you can't operate from your home station in these areas where the test BPL systems have been deployed.
And one more thing I will add to that, and that is, it also has caused great consternation to folks who love to listen to AM radio as well as shortwave.
BPL affects a broad spectrum of frequencies in the lower frequency or longer wavelength bands, including the broadcast band and shortwave. And the FCC seems to have taken a Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead approach towards getting this technology deployed, even to the point of ignoring their own technical committee's recommendations about all the interference potentials to licensed services. And you've got to remember, the amateur radio service is a licensed service, and the FCC is supposed to protect licensed services from radiation from unlicensed technologies. After many, many years of fighting, the ARRL won a decision this year where they took the FCC to task for suppressing data in some of their findings and not making it available to the courts when hearings were being held. They sued the FCC in court, and they won. And now the FCC has been taken to task by the court for suppression of data and information that would be counterproductive to the deployment of BPL technology. As a result, some of the BPL companies have now notched out amateur radio frequencies and changed the technology to where they have much, much less, if almost no, potential interference to the ham radio bands. This would never have happened without ARRL. I think the American Radio Relay League has just done an outstanding job in defending our frequencies. They have also done an outstanding job in administering the VE program under their Volunteer Examination Coordinator Division, their VEC division. They administer by far the greatest percentage of exams in this country. Not saying they're the only one, and not saying that they're the best one, but they do the most. We're very happy with them, and we're happy to be affiliated with ARRL. And whenever someone passes, we also encourage them to look at some league literature and consider joining the league, because they do fight for our frequencies, they do fight for our rights, and they do actually wind up getting us more frequencies from time to time. Witness the 5 megahertz frequencies, the channelized frequencies that they've been that they were successful in getting us. So I'm very happy with the ARRL. Yes, there are some problems with the league, and if you're an organization trying to serve a community, you will never make everyone happy, and you will always make someone unhappy. Where you fail is when you try to please everyone, because in trying to please everyone, you're going to make everyone unhappy. And I think in terms of what they're doing, they have a very, very dedicated group of people who are trying to do the best. I can't imagine anybody at a VEC office that's been more helpful or more concerned or more supportive of the Nashville VE team than the ARRL. Maria Summa, Perry Green, all of the people up at the VEC, Bart Yonke, way, way back in the early days, have just done everything they can to help us and to be fair and to be supportive and give us ways to solve problems that we couldn't have solved on our own. And as a result, we've been giving tests we're in our 23rd year of giving tests, and I wouldn't even think about changing VECs at this point.
We'll be back with our guest, Butch Smith, N4TK, right after this.
As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email, because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO.
Week after week, you hear us talk about Trans World Antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. And, you know, we talk about it, and we tell you, we say, if you want a stealth antenna that can hide in your backyard, if you want something portable that you can take with you, but you don't want to sacrifice performance with a portable antenna system, we tell you, this is the antenna. But you know what? You probably don't believe me. So here's what I suggest you do. If you've been thinking about the 2010, if you have need of a portable antenna, especially during emergency operations, if you participate in emergencies and you need something you can set up quickly and reliably and get on the air, go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. Don't even listen to what we're telling you. Don't pay any attention to what I say. Just go to EHAM and read the reviews. If you're thinking about a portable antenna, if you want something you can take with you on vacation, something that's attractive, that doesn't look like a bunch of poles sticking in 16 different directions, or a fishing pole hung over a tree limb or something, if you want something professional looking, something that's neat, easy, simple, but yet still performs, this is the antenna for you. But once again, don't take our word for it. Go to transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. Go to that site, read what's up there, and then check out the reviews, see what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you.
We are back, and our guest is Butch Smith, N4TK, and he is with the Nashville Volunteer Examination Team.
Well, you know, one thing that we get under the microscope under some criticism because we're such heavy league supporters, but let me say this. You know, what I've encouraged folks to do, and that is if you do have an axe to grind, you feel something is wrong, don't cancel your membership. Increase your activity. Get involved. Get in the middle. And where there's something you feel that needs to be changed, become a part of changing it.
But work proactively to change it. Don't work destructively.
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, because I think that what I've seen and what is proven to be true, and I've watched this firsthand, folks that really work proactively can get the changes they want, and actually without a whole lot of problems. Because there are folks, there are very, very good folks, very, very attentive folks, very dedicated people that are involved with the league, and you get their attention, and they act. You know, they move forward, and they don't. And a good example of that is, you know, who else could sue the FCC and win?
I have been made privy to some communiques from some disgruntled hams over the years to the ARRL. And the thing that disappoints me is the level that a very, very, very tiny minority will go to in terms of profanity, in terms of slander, in terms of outright lies that they will put in letters and emails and telephone calls to ARRL because they disagree with something. Or they have generalized complaints and nothing specific, but they'd rather complain than change it for the better. And I think that hurts everybody.
The other thing, too, from a professional standpoint in the broadcast industry, something that I've noticed, it used to be you would walk into a broadcast facility like a radio station or a radio station group, and on the shelf would be the NAB broadcasting handbooks. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't see those around as much as I used to, but when you're in a radio facility, one thing I've noticed when you get into the head engineering department, when you get right down to where the rubber hits the road, so to speak, you will see multiple copies of the amateur radio handbook on the shelf. Have you not noticed that?
When I was an engineering manager at the Nashville Network, we kept multiple copies of the handbook in our engineering library because, and we would update it from year to year when it became you know, when it became justified to purchase a newer handbook, when they started putting the CDs in, for example. And engineers tend to get those because they know how valuable they are. It's a wealth of information, reference material, and I probably got 20 different handbooks on my shelf downstairs or in my office at work from 20 different years, starting back in 1946, because somebody gave me a 1946 handbook. And each one, it's interesting to go back and read those and look at how technology has evolved.
I just recently procured a 1951 handbook, and I literally got lost in it reading it. It was just amazing. There was things in there that I didn't know even existed. But it's not just the handbook. It's the ARRL Antenna Handbook. It's all the other publications. My goodness, their library, the books that they publish.
You know, you can look at the ARRL Antenna Book and use the formulas in there, and you can build a low-band broadcast antenna, a shortwave broadcast antenna, or a ham radio antenna, or a commercial two-way antenna for a repeater station using that technology. It doesn't have to just be in the ham bands.
And there's all kinds of other information in there. I mean, just, you know, and we have to go back and remember that our basic cell phone that we use every day had really evolved out of the bosom of amateur radio.
One of the things that is inhibiting ham radio growth is the way commercial technology has evolved. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, mid 70s, when we were all on 2-meter FM and had handhelds, and we built repeaters that had telephone interconnect devices we called auto patches, and we put little touch tone pads on the front of the handy talkies we had. Sometimes they were Motorola SB or HT220s. And you could actually make a telephone call from something you held in your hand and other people could see it. That got people's attention. Well, you know what? 10-year-olds can do that now. That's lost its appeal. So ham radio has to evolve to get people's attention and keep people's attention and make them want to become hams. And I think a lot of the youth education and amateur radio promotion that the league is doing is helping to increase the membership and the interest in the hobby. And the VE team concept that the FCC set up back in the early 80s and that ARRL is still administering with our team and many, many, many others is a gateway for these people to get into the hobby.
Well, I think what you folks are doing is just fantastic. And I would so much encourage folks to take a look at what you're doing and become a part of that across the country. Now, does your team, do you all have a website up that folks can look at?
We have a website up. It's not very elaborate. There are a lot of neat websites up. If you've got a second, I'd like to touch on a couple of them.
Okay.
That actually give practice exams. And, you know, if they want to take practice exams, there are probably a dozen websites out there. Some of them just give you the ability to take an exam at the end. They'll tell you whether you pass or fail. Some of them will tell you whether you they'll tell you how many you got right, how many you got wrong, and which ones they were. Others will tell you the theory behind why this answer is right in every one of the questions. So it's actually educational, not just a practice exam. Our website is basically up there for the reason of letting people who are going to come take a test with us know where we are, when we give exams, what they need to bring with them when they come to the exam, and just basically give them information that helps make the examination day process easier. Our website is www.NashvilleVEteam.org. www.NashvilleVEteam.org. It has a schedule on it. It has a contact on there if you want to call and ask questions. It has directions to the testing site, the schedule for the tests, all the materials you need to bring with you, and, as I said, people to call if you have questions that aren't answered on the website. And if anybody wants to go to that website and respond to the information request in there or the contact person, they can help them either come get in touch with someone who can help them form a VE team, or if they're in the Middle Tennessee area or want to test with us for some reason, we'll certainly tell them how to do that. But most VE teams do have websites, and that's really, really a plus with the Internet. We're taking advantage of new technology. We're embracing the Internet. It's helping us do our amateur radio testing.
And we'll have a link. We'll put a link on our website. If you go to our website, which is tedrandall.com, we have a link there to your site so folks can view that. And any other links that you think are helpful, we'll go ahead and put those up as well. The folks that want to look around and examine and become a part of this thing.
There are many out there, and I'll get you a list, and you can get those up there too, including the ones that are active exams on them.
Well, very good. Sir, I want to thank you so much for joining us on this QSO. I've enjoyed talking. It's been informative. I know folks have been sitting on the edge of their seat listening to this, and I know there's a lot of fellows out there that that have wanted to get involved with VE testing but really didn't know what it was all about, or they didn't know how to go about it, and this has been a real good thing. Because we all have to pitch together and as you say, pay it forward to this hobby that's been so good to us.
We need to bring more young people into the hobby.
And it's interesting. Since my my older son David passed the test, I don't think there's been a day that I'm not getting RF'd here in the studio with CQ.
And I've got to remind you that even though you were sick in December and missed our test session, we're going to look forward to seeing you at our next one to get a firsthand glimpse of what it's like to see the wonder on these people's faces when they find out that they've passed their tests.
And I will be there. I wouldn't miss that for anything. Thank you very, very much. Once again, folks, our guest has been Butch, N4TK, and he is involved with the Nashville VE testing team. And this has been a real good visit. Thank you so much, and I hope to have you back again soon.
Ted, we're looking forward to it, and if anyone has any questions, we'll do the best we can to answer them, as I'm sure you will too.
As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email, because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of QSO this week. And we want to remind you that we will not be back same time, same station. We will be back on again weeknights. We have new times, ladies and gentlemen, so consult the website at tedrandall.com. Hopefully, the new time is going to give us better coverage, better propagation, and more folks are going to be able to listen. We appreciate you joining us, and we do invite you to tune in again for the next QSO right here on this same station.